Hey, this is Evan Phillips from Anchorage, Alaska. You're listening to The Fern Line. Alaska, the highest concentration of big, remote mountains in North America. For generations, a unique group of climbers have tested themselves in these vast alpine arenas. The Chugach, St. Elias, the Hays, Neocola, the Kachatnas, the Revelations. Their stories are etched on high alpine walls. Their visions follow lines of cold gray ice. What inspires them? What makes them come back? Who survives? Who suffers? These are the stories we'll tell on Season 1 of The Fern Line. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On Season 1, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of what's possible in Alaska's mountains and beyond. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with an extraordinary group of people, the folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in one of the most beautiful regions on the planet. All right, well, it's great to be back with you all today for another episode of The Fern Line. Before we get started, I want to thank everyone who's contributed to The Fern Line on Patreon in the last few weeks. I've already had 23 folks sign up to contribute each month, and this is just such a huge help in making sure that the podcast remains a sustainable endeavor for me moving forward. So thank you so much. If you're interested in helping support the show, you can get more information at thefernline.com. Or go to patreon.com and search The Fern Line. Other ways you can help out are by leaving a review on iTunes or within your favorite podcast app, or you can simply just tell someone. Tell your friends, tell your coworkers, people you think might dig The Fern Line, let them know it's out there. All right, so with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch or camp chair and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line.
I went to the mountains as a young man to get away from people, but as the more I tried to be alone in the mountains, the more I realized I need people and how important it is to love someone, to love yourself, to love humanity. And I think that's become more and more important in my life.
When I was a kid growing up in Alaska, Vern Tejas was one of my heroes. Back in February of 1988, Tejas made the bold first solo winter ascent of Denali, and in doing so, captured the imagination of all Alaskans, including me. The Denali climb changed Vern's life. He wrote books, gave lectures, and eventually became one of the most sought-after high-altitude guides in the world. But Alaska never remained far from Verne's heart, and he returned each year to guide on the High One. To this date, Tejas has summited the mountain a staggering 57 times, a world record. I recently had the privilege to sit down with Verne and talk about his life in and out of the mountains. We started our conversation by talking about his childhood in Texas and how a rambling life on the road led to an adventurous life in Alaska.
I was a bit of a troubled child growing up. I was a swimmer. My father ultimately became an Olympic swim coach, so I grew up swimming. Had, you know, a 3-hour training every day, you know, for most of my early childhood, from like 7 to 17. I spent a lot of time in the water. Didn't fit in so well in school. Have a lot of energy. And my mom and my father were in the midst of separation. And when I was 12, kind of continued into early teens. What I recall, I was 14 when I took off. I had been previously, when I was 12 years old, I went to Philmont Boy Scout Ranch in New Mexico. So I kind of knew the way there. I knew I wanted to get back to the mountains. I really enjoyed the challenging outdoor experience. And so when I was 14, school was out. My mom was, you know, trying to be the authoritarian that my father should have been, and I didn't like it, so I just said, screw this, I'm out of here. I don't want a lot of responsibility. So took off hitchhiking, ended up in Colorado not too many days later, went to the mountains. At that time, I'd heard the most rugged 14 square miles in the United States, and the lower 48 was in Colorado, in a place called the San Juan Wilderness. So I headed to the San Juan Wilderness, and the idea was I was going to live off the fat of the land and just be a mountain man. But the land's kind of on a diet, and I got real hungry. I took a full archery set with me. I was going to shoot, you know, deer when they walked close enough and things like that. But, you know, it's a skill level that most 14-year-olds don't have. I was learning. I hitchhiking with a complete recurve bow is kind of crazy. Yeah. Getting in and out of cars. But had a big pack. Had a couple books. My Wilderness Home by Calvin Rustrom. And so I was sitting around. I'd just be reading these books and going like, oh, you can make a shelter by, you know, gathering bark and moss and trees and, you know, and putting the limbs together. I had a small axe with me, and it just, the whole idea was I was going to live there. But I got to the point where I was starving in this nice wilderness area.
So that, for you, that lasted a couple weeks, and then you made your way back to Texas?
Well, it lasted a couple weeks until I got so hungry I had to, you know, get back out there. And the first thing I did is, you know, hitch a ride to a truck stop and just ate everything in sight. In my memory, I spent most of the summer on the road, and I had a great time. I actually found out that, you know, being by myself wasn't as much fun as I had dreamt it was going to be. I'm not really a solitary, and I think humans are, you know, we're social animals, and I discovered that at 14 years old, that I had more fun hitchhiking and meeting people and talking to truck drivers and to wives and businessmen and all sorts of different people that I get in the vehicle. And of course they were like, what are you doing? You know, yeah. You got this bow and arrow, you got this huge pack, you're 14 years old, you got long hair. I learned a lot about life really quick. So I spent most of the summer on the road and had a real great time, and realized that maybe I wasn't going to be the solo mountain man that I envisioned. You know how you're idealistic when you're 14 years old, but I'm thinking I need to get experience. I don't even know what I want to do. I need to, you know, try on a bunch of different lifestyles and see what works for me. So for the next 3 years, I would leave in the summer and just, you know, pick up odd jobs, go out to the West Coast, go to Minnesota. I mean, I was all over the United States. And then ultimately we wanted to come to Alaska. So I was hitchhiking across Canada in my late teens and ultimately caught a ride from Whitehorse into Alaska with a guy my same age. Robin Bowen picked me up. He'd just taken his van, his Volkswagen van with a canoe on the top to Whitehorse, threw his canoe into the river and floated down the Yukon to Circle. And then he hitchhiked back to pick his van up, and hitchhiking himself, he was like, you know, likely to pick up another hitchhiker. He picked me up. We hit it off and we became climbing partners for like the next 5 years of our lives.
That's really cool. It's interesting how paths can converge like that.
You know,
you guys just kind of out doing your own thing and you intersect and end up becoming friends that it sounds like had some adventures together moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, it was with him that I went climbing for the first time in Alaska. And so it was like second day in the state. I think we had driven into Denali Park on the north side. And that was back in the day when you could drive a certain way back. And then we took the bus a little bit further in. I think it was Savage Creek. I remember the name. We jumped off there and there was a set of foothills, maybe 5,000 feet high, nothing big, but snow on the top. So we said, oh, let's go up there. First time I'd really been exposed to snow. I was from Texas. I mean, I'd seen it once or maybe twice in Houston, but this time we were actually out in it, climbing in it. It's August the 2nd, you know, hottest time of the year in Texas. But lo and behold, in the afternoon, we got a snowstorm came in. And I'm straight from Texas. I got jeans on. I got a cowboy shirt. I got my straw cowboy hat on. And I had some leather gloves, fortunately. So we're just stumbling around trying to get up to the top of this mountain. No crampons, no ice axe, any of that thing. So we climbed this thing. And as the snow became coming down, I started getting wet and got wetter and wetter to the point where I was shivering pretty uncontrollably, but we still had to get down this thing. So going down, fortunately, is a little faster, so I could get a little body heat. But at some point, we had to camp. And as soon as we stopped, I was shivering uncontrollably. I'd never experienced that before. I didn't know what was going on. I would just know I was miserable. And Robin, who had been in Alaska for 5 years at that point, says, I think you're hypothermic. And I was like, what does that mean? And he says, it means you're really cold. And I said, yeah, I know I'm really cold. He says, keep walking. Just walk around circles around the camp. I'll set up the tent and get your bag in there, which he did. Threw me in the bag. I had to strip my clothes off because I was saturated. So I jumped in the bag. He had a little stove. He brewed up some tea and put a lot of sugar in it and gave it to me. And I slept like a rock for like all the way until like 10 o'clock the next morning because I'd lost so much energy. I was wasted from the climb. From the shivering. And when we got up, it was beautiful. The clouds were breaking. The sun was coming through. Had a foot and a half of new snow. August the 2nd, August the 3rd now. I was in heaven. I mean, it was just so amazing to see the tracks of the animals on the snow. And everything was pristine. I never experienced anything like that. Yeah. From there, we walked back down to the road, the access road. Caught another bus all the way back to the back of the park, Wonder Lake, and we decided we were going to camp there. There's animals still running around on the tundra and everything. It was just like being in the Serengeti or something. We saw caribou going here, grizzly bear going there. And in the background, the clouds are starting to rise up where Denali is. And we're going like, whoa, that's a big, big mountain over there. All we could see was the foothills, and we thought that was the mountain. And then once that clouds came up higher, we could actually see beyond. We could see the Wickersham Wall, which is probably one of the most magnificent rises on all of Earth. I think only Nanga Parbat has anything bigger from base to top. But this, as a young kid from Texas, was impressive. Never seen anything so big in my life. Yeah. Never imagined anything so big. And it took hours for it to fully be revealed. But in the process, the sun went really low on the horizon. It was maybe midnight at the time when it finally started clearing off completely. And you had the alpenglow of yellows and orange and purples and pinks all playing on the mountain as it was unveiled. I mean, I just can remember our energy level just getting higher and higher as the clouds rose. And finally, when we could see the whole thing, Robin goes, "I'm going to climb that." And I said, "Me too."
Inspired by his first experience seeing Denali, Vern moved to Anchorage, working a string of odd jobs and developing his mountaineering skills in his backyard range, the Chugach. 5 years later, Vern got the opportunity he'd been waiting for when his friend and mentor, Jim Hale, asked him to come on a Denali trip he was guiding. The experience changed Vern's life forever, but he'll be the first one to tell you, climbing Denali was never easy.
It was a life-changing experience, and for several reasons. Basically, saved up from my Alaska pipeline days, saved up enough money. I'd gotten 5 years of skill under my belt. I'd done winter climbs, all in hopes to go to the mountain. And the first day on the mountain, I'm so excited, I'm so gunning, that I pick up the biggest load I can, throw it in my sled, pick up another huge bag, put it in my pack, and, take off like a rocket. And I'm just bah, 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 bah. And at those days, again, because we didn't know better, we went all the way from base camp to camp one, dropped our stuff at the bottom of the hill there at the northeast fork of the Kiltna Glacier, and then went all the way back. So you're doing like a 10-mile round trip, half of it with a huge pack and a huge sled. And then you spend the night at base camp. The next day you pull out and you move some more gear and stuff up there. But I was totally hammered by that day. I was sunburnt. I was dehydrated. I had AMS because I was working too hard. And I felt like I was hungover and beat up. And that night I went to Jim and I said, "Liggy, this isn't for me. I'm totally hammered." He says, "Well, I could have told you not to take the biggest load you could handle, but you learn more, you know, by doing it your way. And I tell you what, if you want out, I'll let you out. But let's spend the night here tonight. I want you to eat and drink and take care of yourself and put some sun cream on, for goodness sake. Your face looks like it's on fire." So I did. And in the morning, I was like, maybe I'll give it a second shot. And a reason why I wanted to pull out then is because I knew I'd impact the team if I pulled out later.
Yeah.
But he was smart enough to let me cool my jets and give it a second shot. After that, it just got better. I learned to pace myself. I learned not to push too hard, not to carry a super heavy load. You know, everybody gets their share, but you don't have to overdo it. Yeah. And as the trip progressed, I got stronger and stronger. I'm a slow acclimatizer is what I found out. But if I play by the rules, don't push too hard, go nice and slow, enjoy the mountain. This is what I learned from Jim is have fun. He was always goofing. We rode our sleds down. We did all sorts of things that people don't do these days. Snowball fights, built forts, you know, igloos. We just had lots of fun. But as I climbed and got higher and higher, I got stronger and more self-confident. And then finally, like I mentioned, on summit day, it was to do a double header. Nobody does that, but we did.
Yeah.
And it for me, that gave me a lot of confidence, just knowing that I actually went from getting spanked to accomplishing my goal. And that was huge. If I'd never gone back, that would have been fine. But what happened right afterwards, and this is how it was life-changing, was Jim saw how I grew into the trip. There was another guy on the mountain as well from Philadelphia, and he also really resonated with it, and he and I became good buddies and on the trip. And then Jim said afterwards, he said, "Looky, I've got another guided trip coming up, but it's only two people on it, and it's not cost effective for me to do it, but I can cover your cost if you guys want to go back with this one climber." And I was just like, "Sure." I mean, both of us like, "You mean we get to go for free this time?" And he said, "Well, it's not exactly free. You'll be working," but we're like, "Food? Flight in? Yeah. Come on." So 2 weeks after I climbed the mountain, I was hired as a guide on the mountain. Yeah. This is the back in the good old days. And you couldn't do that now. You got to go through, you know, you got to take courses. And
that's very similar to how it happened for me, too.
Good to hear. But I mean, again, that was a few years back.
Well, that's why guys like you get to be kind of grandfathered in, though.
Yeah. I've been very fortunate. My timing was good. But so 2 weeks later, I am a lead guide with my good friend, JD, John Darges. And we almost kill our client because we didn't know about pace. Now, we're acclimatized. He's not. So we carried the biggest, you know, the bulk of the loads because he couldn't handle it. And then we almost kill him on summit day because we just, you know, we take him too high too fast. We're summiting on the 11th day. And that's, I learned right then and there that after that trip, I never went that fast again. And unless I was trying to solo, you know, if I was doing a speed solo and it was just me, not a problem. But I learned with clients, with climbers that are entrusting their lives to your experience and to your hands, you really have to be conservative.
Yeah.
So never again that fast.
Climbing mountains is one thing, but climbing Alaskan mountains in winter is another. Vern would get to test himself in this arena when he, Gary Bocard, and Paul Denkewalter flew into the Kehltna Glacier in February 1980. The trio would go on to make the second ascent of the Low Kennedy route up the northwest spur of Mount Hunter, and in doing so, made the first winter ascent of the peak itself. I asked Vern to talk about how that trip came together, as well as some of the challenges of climbing Mount Hunter in winter.
And your mind doesn't wait for the time it might take. Settle down and get your feet firmly planted.
Well, like so many things in life, it's opportunity knocking. I wasn't slated to go on it. Nick Parker, my co-guide, or when we were working at Mountain Trip, Nick and I worked together, and he was supposed to go on that, and he was been excellent there. Interestingly enough, he was also working at Overhead Door here in Anchorage, and he'd had an accident at work where he actually fell from a ladder, you know, like 15 feet onto a concrete floor, and seriously messed his leg up. And this is like a month before the climb's supposed to go off. Well, they've already made preparations. Gary's got time off. Paul's pulled time off. They're looking for a replacement, a third. And so Nick says, "Well, ask Vern." I think had I recalled exactly what they were asking me to do, I might have backed out. But you know, they were up for it. Gary was probably one of the best alpinist in Alaska at the time. Paul was no slouch. You know, he runs AMH, definitely had all the gear, all the drive to produce a good climb. So I was lucky. I just kind of fell into an opening with two very capable climbers, and they wanted a third. I mean, in retrospect, they probably should have done it as double, and it would have worked out faster for them. But they also needed a cook. And I didn't realize that that was ultimately going to be one of my main jobs. So we'd climb hard all day. And, you know, it's very short days in February. We'd climb hard all day. And then they would hit the sack and go to sleep. And I would spend another 3 hours making water and food for us. And sometimes it was on my belly. There was a couple of platforms where we didn't have any room at all. So I'd put the stoveboard right on my stomach and put the stove right on top of that and melt water for 3 hours. It was crazy.
That's hardcore.
Yeah. But anyway, the climb itself consisted of the northwest buttress of Hunter. It's the one that you look at when you're at the Kihilton International Airport, where people land to go climb Denali or Foraker. You look straight up this mile-high precipice, pretty steep terrain and heavily glaciated, so things are moving down it quite frequently. And it's wintertime, and it's in the shadow because it's on the north side. And it's right at the edge of my abilities, probably for my whole life, I mean, when I look back at it. But you have to cross an avalanche chute that's pretty active to get to the route. I thought we were going to go kind of skirt on the side of it, but once we got into that chute, it actually did collapse way up high. It gave us enough time to find shelter before the debris hit us. But that just made us all that much more aware we really wanted to be on the ridge. So the ridge is crevassed and seracky, but we were able to find our way around and dig a snow cave right at the bottom of the triangular face, which is this massive blue ice, probably at 60, 65 degree kind of angle at the end of this buttress. Figured we'd smoke up that in one day, even though it's probably only 12 pitches, but 12 pitches with all your gear in the middle of winter, three guys. We didn't get to the top and ended up having to do a hanging bivy. one of the longer nights of my life.
Yeah.
Then we figured from there we'd go get off of the triangle and then camp on the hanging glacier that feeds a lot of these ice falls. It comes down. We didn't get that far either. So we actually consistently overestimated how fast we could climb in winter conditions. And we got to just the beginning of, or just to the top of the triangle when we were benighted again and the temperatures went from 20 below to 35 below or whatever it was. And, you know, so we're doing everything in mittens and huge boots. Everything's slow. But we actually had to chop in a stance. It took us a couple hours in the dark chopping into this probably 70-degree ice along the ridge. It's very hard to see it when you're at base camp, but the triangle face is not right into the mountain. It actually has a ridge, about 300-foot-long ridge, that connects it with the mountain proper. And that ridge is double cornice, you know, whipped cream on a rip saw, just hanging off in both ways. So once we realized that was what we needed to do to get to the mountain, we figured it might take us, you know, another day just to do that 300 feet. We had to camp. So we cut our way into the blue ice underneath the cornices, chop, 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 chop. Several hours later, I was cooking, and the hanging glacier that's about 150 feet away calved off something bigger as this building right here. And there's so much power and force that close to where it's calving off that everything shakes. The ground shakes. The air shakes. Your body shakes. Tremendous vibration while you're cooking. And it was like, that was everything I could do to keep from spilling boiling water all over myself. And the next day, we struggled. I mean, it took us hours to go 150 feet. It was sugar snow, it was blue ice, it was back to sugar snow. We were changing tools, we were changing strategies, basically climbing horizontal across on underneath because the cornices themselves would fall through if you stood on top of them. So we were climbing underneath these things with two tools. And then when we got to the sugar, I was using the handle of my axe, just shafting it, and then I was using a picket as a climbing tool.
Yeah.
I'd stick it into the snow, get it in there, and turn it sideways and pull out on it. I mean, all of it was just a dream as far as whether or not it was going to stay. I mean, it was just, you were hopeful, you were breathing lightly, trying not to vibrate any more than you had to, because you knew that any twerky little movement on you could pull off that whole sheet of snow that was perched on this blue ice. Anyway, we finally got across to about 150 mark. We're halfway across, and it's starting to get dark again. And Gary just goes, "We got to do something else." I'm going like, "Yeah, what can we do?" He says, "Here's an idea. We'll use it in Yosemite. He did the first ascent of the Shield on the El Capitan." He said, "Why don't we rappel off and then swing sideways, pendulum across, and then climb back up once we've gone that 150 feet across?" So that's what we did. We wrapped down, swung as far across as we could, and then left that rope there. We fortunately had another rope. And then climbed back up, and then we got onto a shelf. We were able to camp probably midnight before we got in bed. And then from there, following day, we were able to go to the summit and back down. And then we figured we'd get all the way down the Triangle Face the next day. We didn't get but the upper third of the Triangle Face. But fortunately, Gary had already wrapped down. We were going to run down that thing. But we went to pull the rope. We had hooked it up like a rappel. We were going to do a horizontal rappel pull with it. And Paul and I started pulling that rope, and it got hung up. And we need this rope to get down. I mean, we've got one rope, but we need two ropes to actually rappel down that triangular face. And so we're like, "What the hey?" You know, and we pulled, we put a Z pulley on it. We were reefing on this thing, and it wasn't coming loose. So I start heading back across this horizontal thing underneath these, you know, mushroomed cornices that are hanging over our head. And I lost a good friend to a cornice collapse, so I'm a little bit sketchy at this point, going like, "Oh, okay. Just what I want to do is go underneath these cornices again." And I start going back, and then I start realizing, you know, if that thing does pop, I better have an ascender on. So I put my ascender on backwards so that if it did pop, I would just swing and maybe get torn up on the rocks below, but it might still be there. And then I got so far out there, I was realizing, man, if I swing from 100 feet out, I'm going to get killed swinging. I had to actually put some pro in. Anyway, get back there. There's a knot that it was clean when we pulled it, but as it flicked up and around, it tied itself in such a configuration. I mean, it was like somebody had tried to tie a knot that wouldn't come undone. I mean, it was amazing knot.
Wow.
I was so impressed with the knot that I actually memorized it so I could show the other guys what it looked like. I mean, it was like an angel had tied it. And the reason I say the angel had tied it is because had we actually been able to pull that rappel rope down, we would have been benighted halfway down the triangular face, which would have meant another hanging belay.
Yeah.
Instead, because we wasted so much time going back over, untying it, climbing back across, that we called Gary back up, who was looking desperately for the screws that were now covered underneath a foot of snow.
Because you had left the screws
there. Yeah, because we knew there's no other good route off. So we knew we were going to wrap down. We'd left our iron in the ice. Gary couldn't find them. And so and we just wasted the last couple hours of daylight trying to get that thing pulled. So we called him back up, and we still had that platform we had chopped out earlier. So we actually had an early night that night because we didn't have to do anything other than layer bags out and cook for 3 hours, in my case. Mm. Ultimately, the next day, we were able to descend all the way. And, you know, we'd been on it for 8-10 days, I think, at that point.
Wow, what a trip.
Yeah, and originally, it was only one-third of what we planned on doing. Then we were going to go do Foraker Winter Ascent, right, and then do Denali once we got acclimatized.
Right.
But at that point, everybody was like, "Let's get the hell out of here." So, you know, it sometimes the best laid plans of mice and men go away. But in this case, it still was a wonderful climb. It's most memorable, most alpine thing I'll probably ever do.
I bet.
A winter ascent of a hard route in the Alaska Range. It's the epitome of my technical career.
In 1984, Japanese climber and explorer Naomi Hiramura set out to make the first solo winter ascent of Denali. Struggling through crevasse falls, vicious winds, and stormy weather, Hiramura radioed from the summit in mid-February, saying all was well. He was never heard from again. Four years later, and inspired by the legacy of Hiramura, Vern Tejas gathered his equipment and courage and flew into the Kehltna Glacier to make his own attempt on Denali in winter. The climb tested Tejas physically and emotionally, pushing him to the brink with brutal cold, hunger, and loneliness. I asked Vern to talk about the experience and how the spirit of Naomi Hiramura inspired him along the way.
As you might recall, Naomi Hiramura, a Japanese climber, very famous in Japan, not so well known in the West, but he had climbed it solo in the summertime several years earlier. He'd also single-handedly with a bunch of dogs gone to the North Pole. He'd also soloed floated down the Amazon River. He'd also, at that point, I think he did 5 of the 7 summits, which is all you could do. Russia was closed. No one could get to Antarctica. Pretty amazing guy. He had climbed it in 84. And in the process of getting to the top, put a flag up there, radioed back that he had summited, and he was coming down. And he was never seen again. That particular year, 84, is the year I was traveling around the world. And so I planned, doing a year of sabbatical, basically, and just kick around, find out what the world was all about. But my first stop was Japan. And they were looking for him when I went to Japan. But while I was in Japan, they actually pronounced him dead. And no one could survive 2 weeks up there without food and water and fuel and all the other things. So even though they had a lot of faith in him, he was pronounced dead. So there was a media circus in Japan, everybody speculating what was going on. I actually stopped in and spent a few nights at Naimishi's house. This is one of the guys who, Shiro Naimishi, was one of the climbers on the original minus 148 expedition. Oh, right. There was one Japanese climber. And because he had climbed it in winter, he became sort of the focal point of a lot of the media in Japan because they knew that it could be climbed in winter. They knew who it was. It was this Japanese guy who was on the trip. He actually didn't summit, but he had more insight than anybody else. I was staying in his house as the news people were beating a path to his door. And so he was speculating, coming up with different concepts and theories as what could have happened, what locations he was last seen at, where he camped. And it kind of made me realize how important this particular climber's activity was to the nation. I mean, he was a national hero when he died. I also, at that point, started reading more about what he had done and who he was and things. And one of the things he had done was he'd written books about his expeditions. And he was like the Reinhold Messner of Japan. Not only would he get out there and do these crazy expeditions, he'd write about it. And he'd captured the heartstrings, if you will, of the imagination of the Japanese people. But he had started as a failure. He had dropped out of school. He tried Mount Blanc. He didn't get up it. A lot of the things weren't going right for him. And then finally he hit on this winning combination and then started writing about it. But for me to think of this guy who was kind of a failure and a climbing dirtbag, if you will, of his day, had grown from that into a national hero where people on the street, when they find out I was from Alaska and I was a climber, they would ask me, what happened to Naomi? I mean, just random people. I remember distinctly a very old, withered, shriveled up Japanese lady grabbing me by my lapels and pulling me down into her face and saying, "Where's Naomi?" And I was like, how can a climber touch, the heart of this old lady? It just made me aware that, climbing is not, a solo sport. It's something that other people, even though they don't climb, can actually revel in and relate to, and maybe even gain some understanding of how the world works. I mean, it's amazing that this guy could do that for her. And I started seeing myself as maybe not just this person who'd gone to the mountains, but maybe as somebody who could translate the mountains for the masses. Fast forward, 2 years later, my good friend, also in the book, Minus 148, Dave Johnston, is thinking about going back. He'd guided up there. He'd been up the mountain several times. So I loaned him my Huskies. I loaned him my crampons. And I'm like, you know, good luck. He went up there, skied in from his cabin, which is like 30 miles away from, you know, it's in
Trapper Creek or something.
Yeah, some Trapper Creek. It's the upper Trapper Creek, but, you know, it's still a long ways from his cabin to the mountain, skied all the way in. And he had this device called Bridget, which he had designed. It's a tubular made with aluminum, aircraft aluminum that they would use in hang gliders, right? Big spars, hang glider spars. He had two of those bolted together and cable reinforced. He had these guy lines on so that he could actually bridge a crevasse even bigger than what the skis would do. And he called it Bridget. I thought that was pretty good. But anyway, he had this great design. So when he went up there, he was pretty safe. He could stay out of crevasses. He had good bunny boot skis, good bunny boot crampons. And I'd give him some of the beta on the route. And mind you, this is one of my heroes. So I was trying to bend over backwards to make this as good as it could get. Give him everything that I could give him. I'd climbed it 12 times at that point, I think. Anyway, he ended up in a big storm at about 12,300 feet, just before you get up on the flats below Windy Corner. He was, you know, like between, or just below Squirrel Point is where I believe he got stormed in. And he was able to dig in a shelter there. But because the storm was depositing all the snow from above on top of it, it actually had sealed up his breathing hole in his snow cave. And he told me about halfway through the night, he was probably suffocating at the time, but he woke up hearing footsteps outside. Now, this is February, Alaska Range. There shouldn't be any footsteps outside. But he heard this crunch, 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 and it woke him up. I mean, now he's going like, who the hell's up here? And then he realized he was suffocating because the air hole had been sealed shut with the snow, drifting snow. He couldn't breathe. The door had been filled in. So he went right through his roof, just busted up out of the roof of the cave, got some air, and looked around. There was nobody there, of course. He said he didn't imagine it. And when talking with him, I got the feeling that he thought he was Naomi or Murray's ghost, warning him that he's going to die. Anyway, that was his high point. He ended up getting some challenges with, you know, rebuilding his shelter by the time it was night in the wind. He ended up starting to frost his feet again. He already lost toes on the first expedition up there.
Yeah.
And I think he probably honored his commitment to himself and probably to his lady that he'd come back in one piece. So he turned at that point and skied all the way back. And it was basically, in my mind, it's like one of the most heroic things ever happened. I got to the point that I realized that Naomi was really important figure to the Japanese people. Dave, one of my heroes, was using information that I was giving him. And I could say, like, okay, you know, I've actually been up there more recently, he is, using information and gear of mine. I can do this too. And I also, there's another aspect to why I went there was I knew somebody was going to do it someday. And I wanted it to be an Alaskan. Especially after Dave gave it his best, I wanted to give it a shot too. So that's how it came about. In the process of climbing it, lots of things unfolded differently than I anticipated. As I mentioned, I went to guide Aconcagua. I was working for Jinhae Expeditions at the time. Ray had already passed, and a good friend of mine who I knew through Mountain Rescue, Harry Johnson, had purchased it from Ray's wife. And I was guiding for them on Aconcagua, so I knew I was going to be acclimatized. And that kind of gave me the foot up, the physical foot up that I needed. The ladder gave me the psychological strength I needed to walk out there without a rope going to anybody, to be able to walk through crevasses. I needed a psychological crutch, if you will, just to make sure I didn't fall down.
Maybe just walk me up the climb and just talk about the experience.
My girlfriend drives me up to Talkeetna, getting on board with Lowe, and he's able to fly me in, land, and I had a cache that I made at base camp with extra fuel, a tent, and extra food, just in case, get stuck somehow. While I was doing all this at base camp, another plane lands. And out jumps a guy who I just had been guiding on Aconcagua. Within an hour after landing there, all of a sudden I'm presented with this conundrum of, now this is not me against the mountain or me against myself, and now it's like there's this whole competition component that is, with another human being that's been inserted, not my choice at all. All of a sudden my climb has become this contest, and I'm totally bummed. But at the same time, I realize, we are both on the edge of our abilities. I'm at least got some prior knowledge of the mountain.
Yeah.
But, the chances of him making it are slim. The chances of me making it are kind of slim. But if anything goes wrong, I want him to know that I'm here to help him. And I also want to know that he will help me if I get in a jam. So I go over and shake his hand. I go like, I don't know why you're here, what you're doing, but I just want to tell you, if I get in a jam, I hope you can help me, and I will, do the same for you. He said, sure, thanks. And we didn't talk again.
Wow.
That was kind of it. And then we went our separate ways. I'd see him on the glacier, either behind me or he'd get in front of me, or actually he was probably moving faster because he had less load than I did. He did have a tent. At some point, he realized what I was doing was much warmer and much smarter, so he cached his tent, and then he went up higher, I think, with just the fly, and it was a horrible year that year for weather. It seemed like every 3 days a storm would come in. It would last for a couple of days and then mellow out, and then another round of low front would come in. So we got lots of wind, lots of snow. Anyway, in one of those snowstorms, he got pinned down in his unpracticed snow trench that he built for himself. And evidently it sealed in like they do. And he couldn't get enough oxygen, so he had to get up and keep opening up the door so he could breathe. And eventually got to be too much effort to take his boots off. So he was up and down all night long with his boots on. Feet got very cold and ended up getting frostbite. Unbeknownst to me, he probably pulled out like 5 days into the trip.
Yeah.
Beknownst to me was, there's another person on this glacier, and they are also going for your same goal. But I pushed up in some inclement weather, just knowing that if a California lawyer beat me to the top, my friends would never let me hear the end of it. Yeah. So nothing like a little peer pressure. But so I continued on, and at some point I probably decided that, it wasn't a race. It was just a survival ordeal. Now it's just me in the mountain. So it takes that whole stress and pressure off of being up there with somebody else who could, just totally rain on my parade. Took that out. So at that point, I realized now is just up to making good decisions on my part about when to move, how much fuel to use, how much food and ration things. I was running low at that point because, as I mentioned, it was 3 day storm cycles kept on coming in. I would be able to move one day, but then I'd get storm for 2 days. And when I got to 16, I knew I had to dig in. There was a cave that was there for many, many years.
It's kind of down on the...
Yeah. So I'm digging in, hoping that I hit that cave, but instead I hit a cache of food, okay, and fuel, and a duffel bag full of Mountain House freeze-dried sweet and sour pork.
Wow.
And so I'm in hog in heaven. I'm just eating this stuff like it's going out of style. I don't have to worry about fuel. I don't have to worry about water. I don't have to worry about food. and I eat so much of it. I get to the point where I can't eat it today, but I had it for like a week and a half straight. But anyway, moved up to High Camp, found another cave that was there, which I believe was the same one that Naomi was in, you know, 4 years earlier, because it also is a very well-known high cave that was there for many, many years. While I'm in that cave, I get one of these experiences like Dave Johnston had, where I think there's another human being up there. And I don't hear footsteps. I feel like a breath on the side of my face. And there shouldn't be any wind. I'm in a cave, but the entrance way to the cave is like two body lengths long. It's a very old cave. And so I had crawled in there quite a way. And all of a sudden, I wake up. I feel this breeze on my face. I'm going, wow. And then I feel this, you know, like tingling hair crawling up the back of my neck feeling. I'm going like, wow, there's some presence in here with me. And at that point, I suspected that Naomi was there to either warn me or to comfort me or something. But I felt, and still today believe, that, you know, Naomi's spirit was in that cave. But I was able to just, you know, wish him good morning in Japanese and acknowledge that, you know, we were both climbers and we were both in the same place at the same time and we were both trying something that was challenging. Weather finally, winds dropped down, clouds stayed in there, but I was able to do a run from that shelter to the top and plant a flag, a Japanese flag on the top in my respect for Naomi. That photograph was played in Japan, and it was on the cover, I think, the front page of Mainichi Shimbun, which has got like 4 million readers at that time. Wow. And it was well documented that, you know, not only did I climb it in the winter, able to finally realize what Naomi set out to do, but I did it in a respectful way for him.
Yeah.
And that played well. And it was about a year later, Jim Wickwire, who was a friend of Naomi's, was in Japan and did a presentation and came back with a book of Naomi's history that his wife gave to me. And she signed and said, please give this to the guy who climbed it. It's one of the highlights of my climbing career.
As I sat talking with Vern, it became clear that it wasn't just the mountains that had shaped his life. It was also the relationship shared with others that had made such a big impact. The way he spoke about Naomi, his reverence for his friend Dave Johnston, and the gratitude he felt towards his mentor, Jim Hale. The respect in his voice was palpable. I too felt a reverence as I sat chatting with one of my childhood heroes. Vern's one of those rare people you meet that's larger than life, yet he carries himself with a humbleness and often highlights the achievements of others before his own. He's the kind of person I refer to as a wise man. Before we ended our conversation, I asked Vern to reflect on his life in the mountains, what's important to him today, and where he's headed from here.
So what's important to me now is giving back. I think that's really critical. I've just wrote an ebook on high altitude guiding which is free online. If people go to 7summitspecialists.com, they can download this thing. It's got 7 basic rules and a bunch of tips to help you get you there. This is my effort to get my knowledge out to the public that I've gleaned over the last 4 decades. And hopefully, it'll give somebody else some of the tools that I had to work so hard for, give it to them earlier on. You know, if you can learn this stuff, you don't have to experience it. You know, you don't have to get hypothermic to the edge of death to learn that, you know, avoid that. So giving back's one of the things that I think is important now. I think love in my life is way more important. I went to the mountains as a young man to get away from people. But as the more I tried to be alone in the mountains, the more I realized I need people and how important it is to love someone, to love yourself, to love humanity. And I think that's become more and more important in my life. What's next? I mentioned there's several themes that run through my climbing career, music being one of them. Another one is flying. I love to paraglide. Don't get to do it often enough, but I've paraglided off of the top of Denali and the top of Kosciuszko in Australia and the top of Europe off of Elbrus and the top of Antarctica on Vinson. I've got a couple more flights I'd like to make. Interestingly enough, that's going to be Aconcagua, which is really high.
Yeah.
And it's going to be Kilimanjaro, which has been illegal until just this last year, making this maybe a possible dream. And also to fly off of Everest. But if I complete those flights, I'd love to write a book called The 7 Plummets.
God, that's incredible.
Thing, you know, now that I've climbed the 7 summits, not only at least 10 times, but I've climbed them twice in a 365-day year. Nobody's done that. I've climbed them with a guitar, you'll be interested to know. Nobody's taken a guitar to the top of all these summits. But now I'm kind of shifting. I'd like to actually climb the second highest on each continent. And I've done some of them, but there's some of them that still elude me and are very difficult to get to. So I've got to double down. If the opportunity presents itself, I want to be able to go forward. Some of it's funding, some of it's timing. There's so many things, health, all those things enter into the equation. But if I could climb the second 7 summits, there's a book there, there's a story for sure. It's something that, you know, if I get a little more luck and have another few more years on this earth, I'd like to see if I can pick up that challenge.
Sounds like you have a lot of adventure left in your tank.
Yeah. People keep asking me, oh, so when are you going to retire? I said, well, you know, the way I see it, I've probably got another couple of 2 or 3 good decades left in me.
Well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you enjoyed Vern's stories as much as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his alpine wisdom to your next trip in the mountains. Once again, you can support the Fernline by making a monthly contribution on Patreon or by leaving a review on iTunes or within your favorite podcast app. And finally, if you enjoy the tunes you hear on the Fernline, you can check out more of my music on iTunes, Bandcamp, Spotify, and evanphillips.net. Oh, and speaking of music, anytime you get together with Vern Tejas, you gotta have a jam session. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line.
That's awesome.